welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting shows from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. Coming up in this hour, true history. Later on in the hour, we enjoy You Are There, with the sailing of the Mayflower covered as if CBS Radio News was there from 1948. Right now, it's the Transco syndicated program That Was the Year, their 10th in a series produced in 1935, dramatizing the years of 1898 and beyond up to that point. In this episode, 1919, narrated by Gerald Moore.
That was the year, recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year. January 5, Oyster Bay, New York. In the big gable house known as Sagamore Hill, about 11 p.m.
How you all feeling, Mr. Colonel?
Fine, Jim. A little tired.
Maybe you better rest a spell, Colonel.
Yes, maybe I had. Hey, Jim, turn out the light. I'm in for a bit of sleep.
Yes. I'll be right in the next room, sir.
All right, Jim. Good night.
Night, Mr. Colonel.
The next morning, a shocked world read this bulletin, signed by three physicians.
Colonel Roosevelt retired about 11 o'clock. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, his man, who occupied an adjoining room, noticed that while the colonel was sleeping quietly, he was breathing hard. He died almost immediately without waking from what seemed to be a natural sleep. The cause of death was an embolus.
2 days later, Theodore Roosevelt, 26th president of the U.S., was laid to rest in the Oyster Bay Cemetery. Among the mourners were two allies in the colonel's hectic career, William Howard Taft and General Leonard Wood.
1919. That was the year.
The U.S. Senate Chambers, January 16.
Mr. President! The chair recognizes the gentleman from Texas, Senator Shepard. I have the honor to announce that this morning, Nebraska ratified the Prohibition Amendment, making the 36th state to ratify it. Within less than 13 months, the amendment becomes part of the federal constitution. The shortest time within which any amendment has been ratified, with the sole exception of the amendment abolishing slavery.
January 25, 1919, Versailles, France.
On the eighth day of the peace conference, planned to end the war to end all wars, a resolution to create a League of Nations has been adopted, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States of America has been named chairman.
In accepting this post, said President Wilson,
in coming into this war, the United States never for a moment thought that she was intervening in the politics of Europe, or the politics of Asia, or the politics of any part of the world. The thought was that all the world had now become conscious that there was a single case of justice and liberty for men of every kind and place. Therefore, The United States should feel that its part in this war should be played in vain if there ensued upon it abortive European settlements. It would feel that it could not take part in guaranteeing those European settlements unless that guarantee involved the continuous superintendence of the peace of the world by the Associated Nations of the world.
3 days later found the delegates to the peace conference at odds as to the disposal of certain German colonies. But on June 28th, the Treaty of Peace with Germany was finally signed. Some of the more pertinent terms were:
Germany restores Alsace-Lorraine to France.
Germany accepts the internationalization of the Saar Basin for 15 years and of Danzig permanently.
Germany cedes certain territory to Belgium, Poland, and other allied and associated powers.
Germany renounces all territorial and political rights outside Europe, pertaining to either her own or her allies' territories.
Germany reduces her army within 3 months to 200,000 men, with reductions determined by the Allies every 3 months thereafter, reaching a minimum of 100,000 by March 31, 1920.
Germany abolishes conscription within her boundaries.
Germany accepts full responsibility for all damages caused to Allied and Associated governments and nationals.
On June 29, President Wilson sailed from France, headed homeward, convinced he had played no small part in saving democracy for the world.
1919. That was the year.
Friday, February 21, Bunker Hill, Oswego, New York.
Dr. Mary Walker, the eccentric 87-year-old physician, famous as the only woman granted the right by law to wear male attire, belligerent lobbyist in Congress for rights for women, journalist, inventor of the inside neckband on men's shirts, died from injuries suffered in a fall 2 years ago.
June 15, 1919.
The lazy drone of insects fills a sun-drenched air over a peat bog back of the white chalk cliffs of Clifton, Ireland. No living man is within sight. Suddenly, from the west appears an infinitesimal black speck in the sky. A new drone, ominous, never before heard by the denizens of this Irish marsh. Sends swamp lizards and dragonflies scurrying. The speck grows until it looks like a huge insect itself. At last,
well, off. Here we are.
Yeah.
But where are we?
Well, I don't know quite. But at least it's land.
Is it? Looks like a cranberry marsh to me.
Well, as a matter of fact, it might be Ireland.
Yeah, might be the Sahara Desert.
Well, come along, Art. Let's look the machine over.
Two days later, London, England.
Captain John Alcock and your American navigator, Lieutenant Arthur W. Brown, I take extreme pleasure in behalf of the London Daily Mail in presenting you with the award of £10,000 offered by this newspaper for the first non-stop transatlantic flight in an aeroplane.
Captain Alcock grimly remarked,
"We had a terrible journey, and the wonder is that we are here at all. The fog was very dense, and at times we had to descend within 300 feet of the sea. For 4 hours, our machine was covered by a sheet of ice. At another time, the fog was so dense that our speed indicator did not work. And for a few minutes, it was very alarming. We looped the loop, I do believe, and did a very steep spiral. We did some very comic stunts, for I had no sense of horizon."
Thus did an unnamed British Vickers Vimy plane, carrying English John Alcock and American Arthur Brown to success and reward. But Alcock's enjoyment of his fame was to be short-lived. On December 18 of the same year, he died from injuries received when his plane crashed near Courlevrain, Normandy.
1919. That was the year
that citizens of the U.S. who had never left home shores saw for the first time the awe-inspiring sight of a dirigible floating over their heads to land serenely at Mineola, New York. This was the British R-34. Manned by a crew of 31, she took but 7 days to make the crossing from Scotland to America.
That was the year
that three American naval seaplanes, the NC-1, NC-3, and NC-4, under the command of Lieutenant Commander A.C. Reed, and each man, by a crew of five, started their historic flight from the U.S. to Lisbon, Portugal. Only the NC-4 landed on European ground at Plymouth, England, after a trip consuming 57 hours, 16 minutes. 1919, an historic milestone in the history of aerial navigation.
1919, that was the year
that philanthropist retired steel magnate Andrew Carnegie died, leaving an estate valued at more than $23 million.
That was the year.
Monday, December 1st. The former Nancy Langhorn, Belle of Mirador, Virginia, USA, takes her seat in the British House of Commons, flanked by Prime Minister David Lloyd George and Arthur James Balfour. Representing Plymouth, she is now the Viscountess Nancy Witcher Astor, the first woman to take her seat as a member of the House of Commons.
1919. That was the year
that Henry Ford sued the Chicago Tribune for $1 million, basing his claim for damages upon the editorial comment that Mr. Ford was an anarchist. Consuming 4 months and producing 2 million words of testimony, the trial ended with a ninth ballot of the jury awarding Henry Ford 6 cents damages and costs.
1919. That was the year
that you were reading these bestsellers. Java Head by Joseph Hergesheimer. The Brass Check by Upton Sinclair. The Moon and Sixpence by W. Somerset Maugham. That was the year that you were hiding a copy of James Branch Cabell's Jurgen behind a blank jacket. That was the year that William Gillette was appearing in J.M. Barrie's play, Dear Brutus. That English John Drinkwater's play of the life of Abraham Lincoln was thrilling American audiences with Frank McGlynn in the title role. And that was the year that a pseudo-Oriental tune filtered into the post-war consciousness of a relieved world. And you sang and danced too.
Thank you.
That was The Year on Tuned To Yesterday, a syndicated broadcast from 1935, narrated by the man who would become radio's Philip Marlowe, Gerald Moore.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Knox Manning in Hollywood, taking you on another brief journey behind the scenes. Once again, we draw the curtain to watch a fragment of forgotten drama, a story of people and places already hidden in the background of destiny. Today, we shall meet an amateur boxer who fought the way to his first job. But before that, a word from a familiar voice.
It's an hour of true history. On Tuned To Yesterday, I'm your host, Mark Levinier. Coming up shortly, You Are There with the Sailing of the Mayflower.
That's a very good point indeed. And now, step with me behind the scenes to a hastily constructed boxing ring in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The arena is filled with shouting university students and raucous blue-jacketed sailors on shore leave from the USS Mississippi. We're just in time. The two fighters are moving up the aisle. Let's hurry and see if we can get ringside seats. The college boy had issued the challenge, offered to meet any middleweight from the ship, and the challenge had been eagerly accepted. After all, the champion of the Navy was aboard the USS Mississippi, and he'd show this young student how to wear boxing gloves. No reason to tell the boy that he was going to meet the champ. He'd find out soon enough, probably in the first round. The fight began slowly. The two men moved cautiously, circling the ring, sending out an occasional feeler. The sailor was a little puzzled. He'd expected an excited kid who'd come rushing out from his corner, throw a few wild punches, and then melt into the return blows. But this boy was a little more clever than that. He was waiting for an opportunity. Well, let him wait. The champ had had experience along those lines. The second round was different. Now the kid seemed to know what he was doing. He aimed a short right to the sailor's head and almost connected. The university students roared their enthusiasm. The sailor stepped away quickly. He was going to have to fight back. And fight back he did, round after round, until he realized that he was tiring. The gong clanged. The last round. The sailor stayed near the ropes, out of the younger man's reach, forcing the student to relax his guard. Then the champ lashed forward. It was a final frenzied attack. He pushed his whole body and spirit ahead as his fist pounded the kid's face until it was a ribbon of bruises. But the kid kept up, kept on his feet, and survived these last few desperate moments. The final bell sounded and the crowd waited for the decision. Waited, knowing that the sailor had won on points, but that the student had won on courage. Now, before the conclusion to our story, a word from your announcer. That decision was never given. Before the judges had finished conferring, the student challenged the sailor to another fight. They'd go at it again right now, 10 more rounds, and this time without gloves. The sailor refused and thereby acknowledged his own defeat. Now the arena was a torrent of cheers. The kid had won. A group of shouting sailors hoisted him to their shoulders and carried him out to the street. Afterward, they urged him to join the Navy, but the kid refused. He'd rather be a soldier, he said, and anyway, right now he was looking for a job. What kind of a job, the sailors demanded. Well, the student admitted he'd thought about becoming a teacher, but he was afraid no school would want a prize fighter on their faculty. He sure hoped they wouldn't hear about the boxing match. But the news traveled, and one country school board with a number of unruly pupils decided that a young man who was so skillful with his fist would be an asset to their staff. So, because of an amateur prize fight, the kid got his first job, and from that school he moved ahead until he became one of the greatest fighters America has ever produced. A great fighter, known throughout the world, but not for exploits in the ring, known for the victories he won in the skies of Asia, when he was General Claire Chennault, the leader of the Flying Tigers. This is Knox Manning inviting you to join me again tomorrow at this time for another journey into that dim half-light where chance and destiny lift men out from behind the scenes.
Coming up next, You Are There, a CBS radio broadcast, an interesting program that bonded the CBS radio news unit and members of their dramatic team to relive points of history as if CBS radio news was actually there. In this episode, we hear Harry Marble, Edward P. Morgan, and Walter Cronkite covering the events of September 6th, 1620, better known as the Sailing of the Mayflower. This first aired on CBS on June 13th, 1948.
This is John Daly on the deck of the Mayflower at Plymouth Harbor, England. High tide and sailing time is here this sixth day of September 1620. But this tragic ship with its company of 102 desperate, frightened, hounded souls who are displacing their persons from the old world to the new has not yet sailed. These pilgrims, these refugees for religious freedom and civil rights are still tied to Europe by a Gordian knot of heartbreaking difficulties. And unless these outlaws from the Church of England can cut that knot before the ebb tide sinks them deeper into danger, the Mayflower may never sail at all for the colony of Northern Virginia, recently renamed New England. The afternoon sun is throwing shadows of gloom on the town of Plymouth behind me. Soon we'll be...
Plymouth Harbor, England, September 6th, 1620. You are there.
The Exodus of the Pilgrims. Out of the noose of oppression and persecution, into the arms of an angry sea and a desolate winter continent. CBS takes you back to a little-known but fateful moment in American history. All things are as they were then, except for one thing.
You are there.
You are there is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now...
Plymouth Harbor, England, September 6th, 1620. The deck of the Mayflower and John Daly.
Voyage to the New World and to freedom. Twice they have been delayed for repairs to their sister ship, the Speedwell, which has finally been withdrawn, crowding all into the Mayflower. And now, at last, they must sail with this tide. For today, the weather is good. Tomorrow or the day after, it may be bad enough to prevent their sailing at all, for winter is close upon them. Another delay and the Mayflower would have to face the grisly gales of an autumnal sea and the far from certain arrival in a strange land gripped in the fury of winter. These refugees have already lost their summer chances, and to lose more is suicide. Here with me at our CBS microphone is Christopher Jones, the master of the Mayflower. Captain Jones is one of the most respected shipmasters in all of England. He's one-fourth owner of the Mayflower, a middle-aged, rather sedate man, a strict, strong, dependable citizen. These pilgrims will be in good hands if they succeed in getting away today. But right now, the face of Captain Jones is troubled with deep and anxious lines. Captain Jones, what's holding the Mayflower up? Why don't you sail, sir?
We will sail.
But how can you say that, Captain? Your canvas is still tied down, and the tide is at its height.
Well, I expect my orders momentarily, and we'll sail.
And who are those orders to come from, sir? From the Pilgrim elders who are locked in the cabin?
Yes, as soon as they settle their last-minute differences with Mr. Weston, the representative of the adventurers.
But who are these adventurers, Captain? What is their business with these refugees?
The adventurers, Mr. Daly, are a group of men who are venturing not their persons on this expedition, but their capital.
Well, Captain, do you know what the last-minute differences between these moneylenders and the pilgrims are?
I can't say, sir. Something to do with the contract they agreed upon for the sharing of profits from possible trade in the New World. As if we haven't got enough trouble, Mr. Weston arrives 10 minutes ago and closets himself in the cabin and holds up our departure.
But as soon as these differences are settled and Mr. Weston gets off the ship, you will sail.
I certainly hope so, sir.
Hope? But only hope? Why?
Well, my passengers say they'll not sail without their charter from King James.
But what charter? I hadn't heard about that.
Why, the charter guaranteeing them civil and religious freedom from the King's authority in the New World. Sir Robert Norton, that's His Majesty's emissary, gave his word that he would arrive today.
But, Captain, suppose he doesn't come before the tide has ebbed?
Well, only Providence can answer that question, sir, not I. And now, if you'll excuse me,
One more question, Captain, please. Are all the elders on board the Mayflower now?
They're in the cabin. I'm going there now, sir.
Well, would you care to state who exactly of the elders is on board?
Well, in the cabin are William Bradford, Deacon Cushman, John Carver, and perhaps some others.
And would you care to say, Captain, if the elder William Brewster is on board?
Now, Mr. Daly, it was your desire and your promise to ask but one question. Now, I believe I've kept my bargain. Now, if you please,
well,
sir.
Thank you very much, Captain Jones. The master of the Mayflower is entering the cabin, and we really didn't expect him to answer our questions as to the whereabouts of William Brewster, the ruling elder of these departing refugees. Master Brewster is a hunted fugitive with a price on his head. He is at this moment, and for the past 10 years he has been, the object of an international manhunt instituted by His Majesty. He's been accused of printing a book entitled Perth Assembly, and His Majesty has denounced that book as being, and we quote, an atrocious and seditious libel written with scorn and reproach against the king and his bishops. Printed copies of the book were smuggled from Holland into Scotland in French wine vats. Now, there's a flurry of excitement on the deck of the Mayflower. It's caused by the arrival of a royal carriage. It's speeding at a dangerous pace down the wharf right now, and it must be the arrival of Sir Robert Norton, the King's Secretary of State. The carriage is pulling up now at the boards leading up here to the deck of the Mayflower,
Door is opening. Yes, it is. It's Sir Robert. It's the official who has intervened on behalf of the pilgrims to secure them the King James Charter for the New World. He's coming up the planks now and must pass our CBS microphone on his way to the captain's cabin. I'm going to try to get a hold of him. Sir Robert! Oh, Sir Robert!
Stand aside, please.
Sir Robert, have the pilgrims got their charter, sir? Do you carry the charter?
I said stand aside, please.
Yes, sir. Master William Bradford, Elder Bradford, has appeared at the cabin door to greet Sir Robert. Both men have gone in. The cabin door has been shut in our faces, but we hope that at least one of the difficulties besetting these poor, desperate refugees will be surmounted. This charter is vital to them. Without it, they cannot live under the protection of the king in the New World and enjoy liberty of conscience. You know, this Mayflower seems a pitifully inadequate vessel to brave the vast terrors of the Atlantic, particularly at this time of the year. She's no more than 100 feet, say, from bow to stern, and perhaps 20 to 25 feet at the beam from port to starboard. She has plied good wine and bad wine from every port in France in the past and landed it safely on the London River. And on some occasions, she's carried luxurious taffetas and satins and stockings and coney skins. In fact, the aroma of her last wine cargo still pleasantly escapes from her hold. But on this, her first Atlantic crossing, the Mayflower's cargo has ironically turned from riches to rags. This time, she carries an unusual cargo: men, women, and crying children. And up at the bow of the ship, Ken Roberts, surrounded by these children, seems to have something to say. So go ahead, Ken.
Ready? Sing.
And the earth did shake and quake, and stirred the ground of the mountain shook, for all
the children you hear doing their distracted best to sing one of the tongue-twisting psalms of the pilgrims are being led by a pretty young miss, and she's doing her distracted best to keep them from crying. Good children, very good.
Hush, children.
Would you tell us your name, please, miss?
Priscilla Mullins.
And how old are you, Miss Priscilla?
18.
And is your father a religious dissenter, a pilgrim?
Oh, no, sir. My father is a shopkeeper from Dorking, Surrey. We are French Huguenots.
Hush, why is your family fleeing England if you are not religious dissenters?
Only 40-some-odd of the people aboard the Mayflower are religious dissenters. The rest of us are sailing for other urgent reasons.
Miss Priscilla, what are those urgent reasons?
My father says that there are many on board this ship that flee not the persecution of their souls, but the persecution of their bodies. For as you know, sir, all over Europe, they see the grim and gaunt face of poverty and hunger coming upon them like an armed man.
I understand. And, Miss Priscilla, who are these children you are shepherding? These children here?
4 of them are orphans.
Orphans on the Mayflower?
Yes, poor waifs of London town. Poor orphans dragged off quite as if they were debtors or criminals and sentenced to exile in the colonies.
But by whose authority?
Ask the Lord Mayor of London and his bishop.
Oh, I see. Less mouths to feed in London.
I suppose so.
I see. And what is your name, young man?
Rassel.
Rassel? Rassel what?
Rassel with the devil.
Rassel with the devil? Well, that's a good name.
My brother has a good name, too.
I'm sure he has. What is it?
Love.
What's that?
Love of God. Don't you?
Well...
My father does. He's a great man. My mother says not to tell where he is, but I know...
Rassel, hush.
I won't tell, Miss Priscilla. I promised. My father's in prison, but he'll escape and fight the Indians with Love and me.
Oh, I see. You and Love are two big Indian fighters. And what is your father's name?
William Brewster.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much, Rassel. Miss Priscilla, I didn't know these two were Master Brewster's children.
Oh, yes, there are two more of us. Two big sisters, Fear and Patience.
Of course, Rassel, of course. Fear and Patience. Very appropriate names for the children of William Brewster. Don't you agree, Miss Priscilla?
Yes. My fear is that we will not sail. And as for our patience, that is at an end, and so is our money. My father has sold his shop and all our worldly goods. We have burned all our bridges
away,
behind
all
us.
If we do not...
I'm sorry. There's a man coming through carrying a barrel.
I told you before, miss, to get these children out of here.
Do you want their heads bashed in with a barrel?
You'll bash no one, you lout. I'm trying my best, can't you see? Come, children.
Thank you, Miss Priscilla. Thank you, children.
Children and wenches, as if we didn't have enough. Hey, you. Maybe you know when we're going to get underway.
Soon, I hope. What's your name?
Alden. John Alden.
That barrel you've just put down must be pretty heavy. What's in it?
The body of William Brewster.
In little pieces, I presume.
That would be a story for you, eh? Oh, but it's only beer.
Beer for the sober pilgrims?
Would you expect them to drink ye plain water? It's a prolific source of human ills. Oh, they'll remain healthy as long as I take care of their kegs, or I'm not a good cooper.
Are you one of the pilgrims?
I'm a cooper out of Harwich. I'm hired on by them to care for their beer, their plain water, and their strong water. That's my task on this voyage.
And after the voyage?
Home again for me. I'm hired on for only a year. But if they let this tide run out much longer, I'll never go. Well, enough of this chatter. This barrel of beer wasn't meant for the sun.
Thank you, John Alden. Mr. Alden handles that heavy barrel of beer as if it were kindling wood. Though he can't be more than 20, he's tall, blonde, and powerful. The kind of a fellow who's rough and ready with his hands. No doubt that's why the pilgrims hired him. That's why they... Oh, I see the door of the Mayflower's cabin has opened. Sir Robert Norton has just come out, so back to John Daly.
Sir Robert, the King's Secretary of State, is willing to tell us now what has happened. Sir Robert, has the charter been granted?
I should like to present, if I may, the mind of His Majesty in this matter.
Of course, sir, but did
His Majesty ask me what profits there may be of such an adventure?
By profits, His Majesty meant profits to the realm, I presume.
Yes, and I answered fishing.
Fishing?
Yes, fishing. The departing pilgrims would engage in fishing in the colonies.
And did that satisfy the king, sir?
It amused him. And he replied, so God have me soul, it's an honest trade. It was the apostle's own calling.
I see the king demonstrated his knowledge of theology and of the trade of fishing.
Yes.
But did he, sir, formally consent to the request for the charter?
His Majesty agreed not to molest them should they depart. But he would issue no official seal of protection.
Then the charter was not granted.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. His Majesty referred them to the Bishop of London and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Good day, sir.
Good day, and thank you, Sir Robert. The King's Secretary of State is leaving the Mayflower, but one moment. Oh, Mr. Bradford, we'd like to ask you a few questions. Master William Bradford, in the absence of William Brewster, is the ruling elder of these pilgrims. A rather young elder, I would say, wouldn't you, Mr. Bradford?
I am honored that you call me an elder. I am 31 years old, but we pilgrims age rapidly in the king's protection.
Well, how old is Master Brewster, sir?
Master Brewster is past 50.
Oh, I see.
Yes, he's the only, shall we say, real elder in our company. The rest of us are mostly around 30.
Well, as the present ruling elder, Master Bradford, are you going to follow His Majesty's suggestion that you see the Bishop of London and the Archbishop of Canterbury about the charter?
Have my nose split down the middle? No, thank you. I believe we know what the answer of these venerable gentlemen of the Anglican Church would be.
But, sir, how can you sail without the charter?
To be sure, Mr. Daly, the charter is of great moment to us. Let us not be of too simple a mind about it. Even if we had a seal as broad as a house floor, what is there to prevent the king, if he were disposed to wrong us, from reaching out his long arm even to our new life in America and there claiming us under his civil and religious authority?
Well, then that means that you will sail without the charter.
We sail without the charter. We sail.
No, no, I'll not sail.
Hush,
daughter. I'll not sail. I'll not sail without our boy. Oh, please, William.
Take her away quickly. Take her below. Take her below quickly.
Master Bradford, who is that poor woman?
My wife.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. But you are leaving your children behind?
Our only child. He's scarcely 5. My wife has been mad with grief. Forgive her, please, for she, too, is but a child.
But, Master Bradford, other children are going. Why, just a short while ago, we learned that Rassel and Love, the children of William Brewster, are on board.
Yes, but there's no space for all to go. We'd planned to sail on 2 ships. We are now all crowded onto 1. And some, like my own child, must be left behind. because they are most unfit to bear the brunt of this hard adventure. And thus, like Gideon's army, we are divided, as if the Lord thought we few too many for the great work he had to do. But now, sir, if you'll forgive me, I must return to our business with the adventure.
Well, just one more question, please, Master Bradford.
Yes?
Before you go, could you tell us exactly what the difficulty is between you and the adventurers?
Yes. We had agreed that the fruits of our labor and all profits got from traffic, fishing, and trade should be shared equally with the adventurers for a period of 7 years.
Yes?
Yes. But these bloodsuckers are not content to enslave a man for 7 years. Now they demand 7 days of the week.
Well, how many days had you agreed to work?
Five. And the other two for prayer and for our own profit to build our homes. And moreover, at the end of 7 years, they now demand that our houses and lots be divided with them.
But surely, sir, the land and houses built in the wilderness will be but a trifle to these adventurers.
They do not think so. The division will be a great discouragement to us. We will have to borrow hours from our sleep to build our houses. But they ask if we will sleep better in the stinking London prisons.
That's too bad, Master Bradford, but what are you going to do?
Do? What can we do? We have sacrificed everything we possess to pay for this journey. Shall we turn back now, penniless and destitute and at the mercy of the Star Chamber and torture rack? We are like the children of Israel. But the Lord will yet guide us through this sea of oppression.
Master Bradford has gone back into the cabin again. The people around me here on the deck of the Mayflower have heard the reality of their misfortune. They're discussing it with grim faces and in low tones. And certainly, these people have a reason to be grim and unhappy. So many misadventures have befallen them since they first set out for the new world. A penny, you know, is worth a pound to these poor folk. There's not a wealthy man among them. There's not a patch of purple on these passengers, although they do not wear somber clothes, as many believe. Rather, it's the gay apparel of Lincoln greens and russet browns, the same splash of color that you would see on the streets in London town. Indeed, the missing elder, William Brewster, has been known to wear, at his pleasure, a red cap, a white cap, a quilted cap, or a dandy-laced cap, together with a violet coat and green drawers. Oh, Ken Roberts, up at the Mayflower's bow, has a passenger with two dogs. So over to Ken Roberts.
The dogs you hear barking are a great mastiff and a small spaniel. They belong to a man here beside me who has been quietly sitting on a barrel reading the Bible. He has kindly agreed to put aside the holy book for a few moments and speak with us. Sir, why are you taking these two dogs along with you to America?
Well, why not? Since my wife is not going, a man must have some form of companionship.
Oh, I see, but what will you do with the two dogs?
Do? Why, I shall hunt with them in the wilderness.
Hunt what, sir?
Lions.
Lions? I see. What is your name, sir? Richard the Lionhearted?
You jest. I am John Goodman. My wife's name is Sarah. Sarah Goodman, just these past few months.
Forgive me, sir. Just married and you're leaving your bride behind?
Oh, not of my choice, sir. I left her behind in Delft Haven, Holland. There was not room for all on our little craft, the Speedwell. Now I am fortunate to be on the Mayflower, for all men know the treachery of the Speedwell's captain, who claims the boat is unseaworthy.
Well, isn't it? Didn't it force you to turn back twice and delay you for a month?
I will tell you a secret, Mr. What is your name, sir?
Roberts.
Yes, I will tell you a secret, Mr. Roberts. The captain of the Speedwell and his men are afraid of remaining a winter in the wilderness.
They are?
Yes, but we're not afraid. We fear the wilderness less than the languishing death which we dissenters suffered in the London prisons, where many of us have perished by hunger and cold and by long and hard imprisonment and held without bail in black dungeons where I could not see my hand at noonday. Oh, yes, I remember too well the Star Chamber and how we were whipped and pilloried in the presence of the court. Look, look, I had one ear sliced off, you see. So some have had their noses split down the middle and the letters SS branded on their foreheads.
SS?
Yes, I see you know what that means. Stirrer of sedition. If reading this Bible in the common tongue makes me a stirrer of sedition, it might make me lose my other ear. But have no fear. Have no fear. I'm safe. We are free. I am sailing to the new world. The new world where a husbandman may sing the psalms at his plow and a weaver warble the words of the book at his shuttle. Nay, nay, more. There in America, it will not be many years before a boy that driveth the donkey will know more of the scripture than the Archbishop of Canterbury. And now, sir, may I speak a poem?
Yes, if you like.
I sit upon the deck. Book is in my hand. Do not fear. Heaven is near, I say, by water as by land. I sit upon the deck.
Oh, excuse me, Master Goodman. There's a disturbance on the wharf, a fight of some kind. I see John Daly down there, so down to the wharf.
It was a fight, Ken. One of the ship's passengers walked off the Mayflower with all his family and all of his belongings, and another man who appears to be a soldier accused him of deserting and tried to stop him. A fight flared up, and, well, it's almost over now, I hope, and we'll try to find out what it's all about. Now, look, one at a time, please, please, one at a time. And now, sir, suppose you tell us why you're leaving the Mayflower.
He's a man, a coward, sir, if he fears that his children will be exposed to the miseries of the land and the colonies. Can a man bear to see his loved ones die of famine and nakedness and want?
We are well provisioned.
Provisioned!
Sirs, please, 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 let him speak.
Well provisioned are we. We are in such a strait at present that we now scarce have any butter to brave the winter.
That's not true.
We have no oil, not a hide of leather to mend a shoe. And are we provisioned against the change of air, sir? And the strange diet and the drinking of strange water that will affect our bodies with sore sicknesses and grievous diseases.
But there is a physician and surgeon on board the Mayflower, two of them, in fact.
And can he save us from the savages?
We have muskets, sir.
Muskets? How many muskets against a cruel and barbarous and most treacherous people who are most furious in their rage? For I have heard that they are content not only to kill, but delight to torment men by flaying them alive with the shells of fishes.
How do you know all of this?
I know. They cut up a body piecemeal. They broil it over the coals and they eat the collops of flesh in their sight while still the body lives.
You seem to be well informed, sir, about places you've not been to.
Aye, sir, verily I am informed. I am informed that 1,200 immigrants have sailed from England these past 3 months. 1,000 died on the voyage or after their arrival in the Virginia colonies. Now answer that, Captain Shrimp.
Who are you calling Captain Shrimp?
You can...
Just a moment, please. Just a moment.
I'll shred him to pieces.
Please.
Yellow livid libelous. No one can call me Captain Shrimp.
Just a moment. Shrimp.
My name is Captain Miles
well,
Standish.
Well, then,
you are
calm down, Captain Miles Standish.
Captain Shrimp, will you?
Aye, Shrimp.
Captain Standish is a short, stubby fellow with a flaming head of red hair that now matches the crimson rage in his face. Well, what are you captain of, Captain Standish?
I'm a military man.
You are a shrimp.
I fought with the Dutch against Spain. And any flea that calls me Captain Shrimp will find that I am a little chimney that is quickly fired. And should this cowardly deserter, this pernicious, poor...
Captain Standish, now Captain Standish, please. By what authority, sir, did you try to dissuade this man abandoning the voyage? Are you an elder?
No. But I've been chosen by the elders to preserve order and lead the Pilgrim Army in the New World.
You mean you're going to protect them against the savages?
I will protect them against any enemy, man or beast.
Well, I presume then, Captain Standish, that you are one of these pilgrims.
No, sir. I am a Roman Catholic. My task is simply to protect these people, even from such a deserter as this one.
I am not a deserter, sir.
Please, please, please. You've had your say.
He is stirring up fear among us. But we will be strong, even though today we are weak. With the help of God, there will come a day when the bees will have honey in their hives. And then they will also have stings in their tails.
I will not be...
Excuse me. The Mayflower cabin door has been flung open, and the agent for the adventurers, Mr. Weston, is striding swiftly across the deck. He's coming off the ship and coming down the boards here to the wharf. He looks very angry. Perhaps I can stop him to say a word. Mr. Weston! Mr. Weston!
No comment.
But, sir, is the Mayflower sailing?
Let me by, please.
Just one question, please, sir. Has the contract been settled?
There is no contract.
But, Mr. Weston...
I have no time. If they leave, they stand on their own legs.
That's Mr. Bradford, sir. He's come out of the cabin and he's coming down the board.
Let him come. He'll do no business with me. Bloodsuckers, are we? Are my investors to be called bloodsuckers simply because they want to protect their money?
Weston, the new contract you propose is fitter for thieves and bond slaves than honest men.
I bleed for you, Master Bradford, but I'll not risk another penny of the adventurer's capital.
I understand. He that ventureth his money hath more power than he that ventureth his person.
We've been through all that. If you've nothing newer to say, then let me by.
We have a new proposal.
Then speak it and be quick.
Very well. Here it is. In return for 2 days and every 7 to build our homes, we will agree, if necessary, to guarantee your profits, though it take us more than 7 years. Will that suffice?
Then you guarantee our profits. That's reasonable. I think the adventurers will agree. I accept.
So be it. Begone, then, and let us sail.
Godspeed.
Captain, we sail at once.
All on board!
Godspeed, Master Bradford. Bradford is gone up the boards, and those are on the wharf here are hurrying up after him. Captain Jones has given the order to raise the hook. There's a whirlwind of activity up there on the deck of the Mayflower. Sailors are shouting, leaping up into the rigging. The sails are going up, beginning to belly out into the wind. Captain Jones is wasting not a moment. He means to catch the last full strength of this tide. And now, a surprise in these last minutes before sailing. Elder William Brewster, the fugitive leader of the Pilgrims, the man with a price on his head, is on board the Mayflower and with Ken Roberts. So now, back to the cabin.
William Brewster is here, sitting across the table from us in the Mayflower's cabin as it gets underway to the new world. Master Brewster, will you tell us where you have been?
Some say I have been to London, some to Scotland, and still others to Holland. All are correct, but for the past hour, as you know, Mr. Roberts, I've been sitting in the hold of the Mayflower.
Master Brewster, how do you feel now that finally you're about to sail for a new land?
We are departing on a great venture. In the new world, we will establish a new form of living with ourselves and with God. I fervently pray that maybe next year, God willing, the Mayflower will return, perhaps with a cargo of salt fish and pelts, and sell them at a fair profit. And then when she sails again to America, many more families will go with her. Our men will build their own houses and till their own fields. And our women will weave Sunday clothes for their own families. We will all enter our own church and worship in our own way. Please, God.
A happy success on your hopeful voyage. And now, Master Brewster, I must go ashore, so Godspeed again. And back to John Daly on the wharf.
The lines have been cast off. Captain Jones is urging his crew on to hurry. And there it goes. The Mayflower is sailing. The people here on the dock are waving and weeping. It's a noisy, but at the same time, a tragic scene. Many of these people will not see their friends and relatives for perhaps years. The Mayflower, her sails filling and the wind is heaving through the water, making her way towards the Catwater and the Sound, bound for the New World and New England. The sun is setting. The sun is setting against the rolling white clouds.
September 6th, 1620. The Pilgrims sail for America to establish the first colony founded on civil and religious liberty.
You Are There on Tuned to Yesterday from June 13, 1948 on CBS. We now close this hour with some radio history with an excerpt of Behind the Mic from September 29, 1940 on the NBC Blue Network, profiling what goes on with one of their earliest shows called The Morning Patrol with host Don Cordray and MC Graham McNamee.
The story behind the Blue Network's earliest morning personality. Ladies and gentlemen, long before most of you have risen from your downy cots, a certain young man is standing before a microphone introducing a radio program. His is the first voice you hear on NBC's Blue Network in the morning, provided you're up that early or that you haven't gotten to bed. We thought it would be a good idea for you to meet him. So here he is, Don Cordray, announcer of The Morning Patrol. Candidly, this is the first time I've ever seen him, and I've been around these many years. Don, what is the Morning Patrol, and what time does it go on the air?
Well, Graham, the Morning Patrol is a program of recordings, mostly dance recordings. We go on the air at 6:30 a.m.
Man, oh man, 6:30 a.m.?
Uh-huh.
Since you're the first one on the air for this network in the morning, maybe you can tell us how the networks open up each day.
Oh, certainly. With the announcement of the station and the playing of the Star-Spangled Banner.
I get it. If the alarm clock doesn't get the listener up, that will.
That's right.
What time do you have to rise to be at the studio for your show, Don?
Well, I have to come in from Forest Hill, so I set the alarm for 10 to 5.
Oh, 10 to 5. Well, isn't that a little premature?
Well, you know what they say, Graham. The early bird catches the worm?
Yes, but until you develop feathers and a long beak, that won't interest you. What's your daily living schedule?
Well, I get up to 10 to 5, reach studios at 10 past 6, and I'm on call until 4 in the afternoon. Then I go home and sleep until 6, and then I'm fresh for the evening.
Go to bed about midnight and then get up at 10 to 5 again.
10 to 5. Not a bad price. And you have to be here at 10 to 6, do you?
Well, not always, Graham. You see, they used to have a rule here at NBC that if anybody was late for an early show, they were subject to dismissal.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I'm very careful about setting my alarm clock. Well, one night after setting that alarm, I locked it by pushing down a gadget on top of the bell. When the alarm went off, it was pitch dark, but I arose and got to the subway all right. I didn't seem to recognize any of the regular crowd. When I reached NBC, the front of the building was locked, and I had to go in the side door. Now, this, to me, I thought, is on the strange side. But I went inside, and the elevator operator said, "Well, a special broadcast?" "No." But to make that long story short, I reached the studios at, you want to guess what time?
No.
3:45 in the morning.
3:45?
Yes, when I locked the alarm by pushing down the gadget on top, it had thrown the setting hand back to 3:45. But generally, I get to the studios around 6.
Oh, I know that, Don. I see you right along here at 6:15 in the morning, yeah.
The only time, Graham, I ever saw you at 6:15 was when I was going to work and you were going home. And not from work.
Touché, Don. 6:10. Oh.
An excerpt of radio's own history show, Behind the Mic, from September 29th, 1940, on the NBC Blue Network, with Don Cordray and Graham McNamee. That wraps this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. It's been a pleasure.